nationwide warranty by ASE certified technicians. Located near the U of I campus with shuttle service available. More information is available at 367-0300.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the life and work of Henry Adams. He was an historian, a journalist, a member of the famous Adams clan. His great-grandfather was John Adams. His grandfather was John Quincy Adams. He's someone who today is perhaps best known for a book that he wrote when he was in his 60s, a book titled The Education of Henry Adams, that is in part autobiographical. It's a kind of a memoir, but it's also full of observations about American history and politics. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking with Gary Wills. He's an adjunct professor of history at Northwestern University, who says that we have forgotten what was perhaps the greatest book or books that Henry Adams wrote, his 9-volume history of the United States of America during the administrations of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Wills has written about Henry Adams and about his work in a recently published book, which is titled Henry Adams and the Making of America. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and it's out now in the bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it. Gary Wills is author himself of a number of books, including one that won the Pulitzer Prize, that book titled Lincoln at Gettysburg. He has also won 2 National Book Critics Circle Awards and the 98 National Medal for the Humanities. And as I mentioned, he's adjunct professor of history at Northwestern University. He is talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many callers as possible, keep the program moving. So anyone, though, who is listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Mr. Wills, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us today.
Glad to.
We appreciate it. I have not read The Education of Henry Adams, although now I've at least read some things about it. And I was struck how in the book, when you're talking about how frequently it is referred to as an autobiography, and that you said your feeling was that that's not entirely the correct way to describe it. And in fact, Henry Adams himself would probably not have put that on there. The publisher put that on there. And I guess really this was only after Henry Adams had died. The book even won the Pulitzer Prize, but he didn't live to see that. Talk a little bit about The Education and what kind of book that is.
Well, The Education was written at the end of his productive career before his stroke. And it reflects a great deal of disillusionment that had come over him by the time he was in his 60s. It's a very ironic, fairly sardonic book, and the last chapters of it are not about him at all, but about entropy, about the way the world is racing toward a depletion of all its energies, a scientific theory that doesn't have much validity. Up to that point, he uses himself as a example of what he calls an essay in disunity. He had done another book which he called An Essay in Unity. He tells the story of Henry Adams in the third person, who kept trying to get an education and failing. He said he tried to be a teacher and he failed. He tried to be a journalist and he failed. He tried to be an historian and he failed. He failed at all these things, and just shows the futility of life. It's elegant, sarcastic, as I say. It's a favorite of English departments who don't pay much attention to the history work that he had done earlier. And it's generally false. That is, he didn't fail at any of those things. In fact, when the book came out, his students at Harvard said, how can he possibly say that he failed there? He was our most inspiring teacher. And these students were now presidents of universities and heads of history departments. He set up the first graduate program in history at Harvard, graduated the first doctors in history, including Henry Cabot Lodge. And he left because he had served the purpose that he wanted. And the other most important history graduate program was at Johns Hopkins University, and they begged him to come and lead them, and he didn't. So for whatever reason, it has a lot to do with psychological and economic setbacks that he had undergone. It's a very sour book, and people, when they think of him now, they think of that as quintessential Henry Adams, that he must be pessimistic and skeptical of democracy and skeptical and critical of America. He wrote to friends saying, there'll only be a couple of people who will understand this book, and you're one of them, and I don't care about the rest. Well, that's a very different Henry Adams from the one who wrote his major historical books when he was in his 40s. That Henry Adams was optimistic, progressive, and patriotic, very chauvinistic almost about the War of 1812, which he celebrates in quite lyrical prose. Why did people not think that was the case? Well, there's a certain concatenation of accidents. The people who have read the history have read mainly the opening six chapters of Volume 1, which is the State of America in 1800. And the State of America in 1800, as he describes it, was quite dire. It was a divided country. The regions were inbred and parochial and unprogressive. Its religion was intolerant. Its science was non-existent. Its intellectual energies were all faded. And they say, well, that's what the whole history is going to be like, and that fits in with what we know about Henry Adams. He didn't think much of America. And so they dismiss the rest of the book and don't read it. And more astonishingly, they don't read the last four chapters of Volume 9, which are bookend chapters to the first six. And that describes an America that's totally, totally different. He said, now it's progressive, it's energetic, it's united, it's pulling itself together, it's making its way onto the world stage. And all this came about in the 16 years of the Republicans' rule. The opening chapters are about the year 1800, the year when John Adams was defeated by Jefferson. It describes the state that the Federalists had left the country in after 12 years of their rule. And so the picture that he gives is of Federalist stasis and inability to keep moving and Republican takeoff. Now, that goes against a lot of the presuppositions about Adams. It's often said that he's a defender of his family. In fact, very famous historians have said that the history is simply of carrying on a family feud. He's attacking Jefferson because Jefferson defeated John Adams and didn't treat John Quincy Adams with as much respect as Henry would have liked. Well, all of that is false. He had a very low opinion of his own family for an interesting reason. The one member of that family that he deeply loved was his grandmother, Louisa. And she was Louisa Johnson of Maryland. She was not part of the family. In fact, Abigail, when her son married Louisa, Abigail Adams, had said, she's only a half-blood. She's not really one of us. And she made life quite miserable for Louisa. Well, Henry knew and loved her as a boy, and he read her diaries and papers. She was an aspiring intellectual who felt crushed by the Adams family and sacrificed to their ambitions. And so Henry, when he read those things in his late 20s, decided he was going to publish them. If he had done that, it would have just crushed his father to say that his mother had felt a victim of his father, of John Quincy Adams. But Henry went forward. He put together her diaries, into conflated them into one continuous narrative, wrote them all out in his meticulous hand. That was going to be volume one of three volumes of, of the papers of Louisa Johnson Adams. And you can read it now in the Houghton Library at Harvard. It's not in the microfilmed Adams papers. It's largely a forgotten thing. But once you see that, you see that he considered John Quincy Adams, he calls him demonic for the way he treated his wife. And when his brother Brooks wrote a biography, a celebratory biography of John Quincy Adams, he gave the manuscript to Henry, and Henry slashed it all up and said, you can't say this about him. This man was a pretender. He was not the pillar that you make him. And Brooks was so crushed that he never published the biography. So that this whole idea, which is very, very common, that the history is an attack on Jefferson and the Republicans and a defense of the Adamses and the Federalists, is totally false. In fact, when he was teaching at Harvard, his prize graduate student was Henry Cabot Lodge, and they didn't have teaching assistants the way we do now, but that's one of the innovations that Henry came up with. And he explained to the president of Harvard that he wanted his teaching assistant to help him teach the early American history because he could defend the Federalists in good conscience, and Henry could not. Henry took the side of the Jeffersonian Republicans. So now we have to reread the history, now that it's back in print. It fell into such obscurity that it was out of print for most of the 20th century. Now the Library of America has brought it back, all nine volumes printed in two volumes, but with very clear print and very attractive volumes. And it reads like a mystery story. It's so well done. It's his great work that he spent decades on. And he institutes all kinds of new kinds of history. That's why he went to Harvard, to teach himself as well as teaching his students the new historical methods. The 19th century had moved away from the old philosophical history of the 18th century to what they called scientific history. Philosophical history was based on the fact that public records were only the published things. Secret archives were not available. The monarchs and the bishops and the popes and other people kept their archives sealed. But the revolutions of the 18th century, of the late 18th and early 19th century, opened up many of these archives. And so people were no longer conjecturing from the public record what people were saying in private. They could go and read them. Well, that excited Henry Adams. And he went to the archives in Europe, in London, in Paris, in Madrid, in Seville, and was the first one to get into these and proved from them things about American history that had been mysterious or forgotten or unknown. For instance, it was not known exactly what Napoleon wanted to do with Louisiana before he was forced to sell it to us by the failure of his Caribbean adventures. And Adams found exactly what he was going to do. He was going to set up a counter-empire against America. And the instructions sent to his generals and admirals, Henry Adams copied out and brought back to America. More interestingly to him, he found out what Aaron Burr was up to. He proved what Aaron Burr was up to. Burr had been accused of wanting to separate off the western parts of the Union into a separate nation. And he said, no, that's not true. I was raising some troops, but they were simply to help invade Mexico if we went to war with Mexico. But Adams found in the European archives that, in fact, Burr had gone to the diplomats from Britain and France and Spain and said, I'm going to separate off the part of this country if you will finance it for me. Give me money to do it, and then you will be in a stronger position over against America. So he came rushing back with that material. It was so hot and interesting that he couldn't wait to put it in the history. So he wrote a brief biography of Aaron Burr using all that material. It's just the story of the making of the history and of the new resources that he turned up and the new techniques he used is fascinating. Like many historians in the 19th century, he had to be wealthy. There were not foundations and grants and archival resources, curators and research universities and all that kind of thing. So most of the historians in the 19th century had to finance themselves or have a wealthy patron that did it. And, of course, Henry Adams had money from his maternal grandfather. He was in the first generation of Adamses that had money, and all his money came from the Brookses. His mother was a Brooks, the daughter of the richest man in Boston. So Henry and his siblings had money. He went to Europe, and there were no Xerox machines then. He had to hire a whole number of scribes, and he had uniform-sized paper, which he gave to these scribes. He would go through and make lists of copy this, copy that, copy that, copy that. Then he would leave, and they would do it and send it to him on these uniform-sized papers, and he could bind them into 20 volumes, large, big, bulky volumes, archive by archive, that he used as his primary sources for that part of the history. They're now in the Library of Congress. He left them there. So all of the story of the making of the history is fascinating. And then when you read the history, you see how elements of Louise's experience in Washington play into it, and how fascinating characters are created by Adams out of very authentic materials. For instance, Toussaint Louverture, the great black revolutionary in Haiti, or Tecumseh, the great Indian warrior, or John Randolph, a kind of Shakespearean jester figure. Just a fascinating story.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus, let me just reintroduce, is Gary Wills. He is adjunct professor of history at Northwestern University, author of a number of books, including a new one, which is entitled Henry Adams and the Making of America. It's published by Houghton Mifflin and is indeed about Henry Adams, who was an historian, a journalist, a novelist, one of the Adams family. His great-grandfather and grandfather both were presidents of the United States. He is, as we said at the beginning of the program, perhaps best known today for a book that is often read in universities in the English department, a book titled The Education of Henry Adams. But Gary Wills says that something we have forgotten is that he was a great historian and should be known for his history, his nine-volume history of the United States, and a book that, as he said, for a long time was not available and recently now has been brought back into print. So that certainly is something that you can read. And if you'd like to read Henry Adams and the Making of America, you can find that. And questions are welcome here, too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And among there's so many things about this man that I think are really fascinating, his life. I guess one of the things that strikes me is that even though he had been educated at Harvard, when he was hired on there to teach history, he had no advanced degree. He had no formal training in history. He was hired to teach medieval history, something which he really had to teach himself to be able to teach it. And in spite of the fact, as you say, that he later in life said, well, I failed at everything. He said he thought he was a bad teacher. His students, when they read that, they said, no, he was a great teacher. He's saying that, but we think that he was a great teacher. How did he manage this? Not only was he a great teacher, but he had to teach himself, train himself to do history before he could actually train anybody else to do that.
Well, medieval history was a new discipline. Most of the people who were pioneers in the 19th century had been trained as classical historians, not medieval. And again, it was a matter of largely of getting to original archives. He had met a number of those people when he was serving in England during the Civil War as his father's secretary. His father was our diplomatic emissary to England during the Civil War, and Henry was his secretary. And he had met some medieval historians. And when he came back to America, he began writing learned essays in the North American Review, which was edited by a man who was in the history department at Harvard. So that connection was developed, and the editor of the North American Review told the president of Harvard that Adams was actually very alert and picking up on this new medieval history discipline, and if he were appointed, he would be able to do a good job. Well, when he was appointed, he took a year off and went to Germany and talked to the pioneers of the new historical method and taught himself Anglo-Saxon, taught himself, well, he had already known German, and told his first graduate students to take some aspect of medieval law in England and work it up into a dissertation, and then he published the collection of those dissertations as a volume with an essay by him. So by the, after 6 years of teaching, he had thoroughly versed himself, and in this time he was also editing now the North American Review and reviewing a lot of the new historical works or assigning them for review to other historians. So he did a kind of crash course in historical method, and especially the new archival approaches of medieval history, and trained his students in that. That's all he wanted, really, from that experience. He knew he was going to be an historian. He wanted to be. He had said that. He had written that back to his brother when, the first time he went to Europe. So between the journalism and the editing of the North American Review and the teaching at Harvard, he felt that he had equipped himself now. And then he got a job editing the papers of Albert Gallatin, who was the Secretary of the Treasury under both Jefferson and Madison. So he, in doing that, he got into the daily record of what was going on inside both those administrations. He wrote, he edited the papers in two volumes, and then he wrote a biography of Gallatin. Then he wrote a biography of John Randolph. Then he wrote the biography of Aaron Burr. All of these were preparatory to the nine volumes on the same years. He was covering the same years at various levels of depth and research and angles of approach. And so he, when he went to the history, he had prepared himself in statistical method, in all kinds of new disciplines, in military history, intellectual history, social history. A forecast of that was something he did when he was at the North American Review. In 1876, 100 years after 1776, the Declaration of Independence, he commissioned experts in various fields, law, religion, education, the economy, to say what was the state of America at the end of its first 100 years of existence. And as he went through that and edited all of those things, he was again teaching himself how to approach the condition of a country from all these different angles. And so it was a kind of preview of the first six and the final four chapters of the history, that one single volume of the centennial issue of the North American Review. So all, in all of this, he was succeeding spectacularly. It makes it so odd to read about all of his failures in the education of Henry Adams.
He was born in Boston and was educated at Harvard and taught at Harvard, but as you say, he had this strong connection with the South. He, you write at one point that he felt himself a kind of honorary Southerner, and in part that might have to do with the connection that he felt to his grandmother, Louisa, who was the wife of John Quincy, who was herself a Southerner. How did that pull to the South shape him?
Well, when he visited, Louisa's family lived in Washington, and when her husband died, when John Quincy died, she went to live with them in Washington, and Henry visited her there. And from that first visit, he just fell in love with Washington, the city of Washington. And his great hero at that time and all his life was George Washington. In his first novel, the heroine is the widow of a Virginia Lee. The most admirable character is a Virginian. And in the most striking chapter of the book, one that Henry James admired a lot. They go, all the main characters go on a visit to Mount Vernon. And as they're talking about George Washington, he becomes a kind of touchstone to reveal the character of each of the persons who's considering him. So he loved the Virginians. The people he admired most in American history were George Washington, John Marshall, a Virginian, and Albert Gallatin, whom he considered a Virginian too, although he ran for office from Pennsylvania before he became the Secretary of Treasury. But when he came to America, he took out his citizenship in Virginia and did early farming there, and his early patrons were John Marshall and Patrick Henry. So he considered himself somebody who was very close to the Virginians. In fact, one of his best friends at Harvard was the son of Robert E. Lee, Rooney Lee. And they were close. And on the night when Abraham Lincoln came to Washington to be inaugurated, when he sneaked in,
I'm sorry, Mr. Wills, but we just had something strange happen with the telephone there, and suddenly you got very muffled, and I'm not really sure what's going on here. Well, I tell you what we're going to do. We'll see if we're going to fix that up. Just let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Gary Wills. He's an historian and critic. He's authored a number of books. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Lincoln at Gettysburg. He's also won two National Book Critics Circle Awards. He's an adjunct professor of history at Northwestern University and is the author of a newly published book about this man that here we've been discussing, Henry Adams. The book is titled Henry Adams and the Making of America, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. And now I think we got the connection set up again. I'm not quite sure what happened there, Mr. Wills, but suddenly you were very muffled that we could almost not hear you at all.
Okay, well, I'm back now.
Okay, yes, we have you on now.
Good.
Well, I tell you what, I have a caller to bring into the conversation, so what do you say we go and talk with that
person?
Someone listening this morning in Charleston, Illinois, that is, and on line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I read Mr. Adams' book 20-some years ago, and what I divined from the writing was, one incident that sticks in my memory, if I have it right, is Henry Adams' discovery of the in the Civil War, the English support for the South, and bringing them munitions and whatever, you know, would support the Southern cause, which I interpreted as meaning that the English kingdom saw a crack. And somehow, if they could get, you know, an influence of the affairs, like you said, of Aaron Burr and I can't remember the other one just now, but the people who are trying to make their way into what the U.S. appeared to me to be at that time, and still so, a bonanza of some sort. It was Napoleon and Louisiana, you know, and somehow, and knowing too that the Spanish were going to be thrown out of the Western United States at some point. I think that was mainly under Jackson. It wasn't that, I think, you know, those wars. And it all came to me overall as a cluster of interests that saw the riches, both human and natural, that the U.S. Presented to every foreign power that had the ability to get here. Am I remiss on those things?
Well, you're talking about several periods, about Jefferson, yes, and about the Civil War and about Jackson. Those are three different periods,
yes,
and they have different dynamics. The one you started with, when he was in England during the Civil War, he was very upset that the British were supporting the South. That was because they had interests in the cotton that the South sent over for their mills. They didn't want to invade or take over the South. They wanted to support the South just because of their economic ties. And Henry's father fought that. So, but he blamed the British for that, and it made him something of an Anglophobe for the rest of his life. But his attitude toward the South was such that he didn't blame the South so much. He was an abolitionist who wanted to get rid of slavery, but after the war, he was very friendly with Southerners and opposed President Johnson's Reconstruction attitude. He was against the 14th Amendment. He wanted slaves to be free, but he didn't think blacks deserved the vote. So his Southern sympathies went too far in that regard. And his attitude toward Jefferson, he was not very censorious about the fact that Jefferson was a slaveholder. He criticized Jefferson on some grounds, not nearly as much as he criticized his Adams forebears, but he was fascinated by him, and there was a kind of congenial bond between them. They were both aesthetes. They were both art collectors. They both built beautiful homes. They were both great prose stylists. As I say, Henry was an Anglophobe and a Francophile. He liked France and didn't like England much, and the same was true of Jefferson. Henry was suspicious of banks, as Jefferson was. So there were many, many ties to the South, to Virginia, to Jefferson even, that have almost been totally wiped out of the record as far as most people are concerned.
Yes, well, and one last comment. It also occurs to me that from the beginning, you know, the independence in 1776, and then the extension of bourgeois capitalism and the abolition of slavery drove home the point that slave labor would no longer do, and wage slavery then was put into practice. And labor became, you know, not a property, but just a natural resource. I'm not stating it very well, but it occurs to me that from those times until the present, that the bourgeois class are the only people who experience democracy. Everybody else is just pulled in the train. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye.
Anything you'd want to comment on that?
No, I don't think so.
All right. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that some historians in the past had dismissed Adams' history, saying that, well, really what he was doing was he was just defending the honor of the Adams family and his Adams forebears. And your argument was that this is really based on a not very complete reading of what he had done. And in fact, as you write about in the book, that he had really very little good to say about either his great-grandfather John or his grandfather John Quincy. Why did he feel so, I'm not even sure if ambivalent is the right word. Maybe it's actually, he actually had negative feelings about his forebears.
Well, there are several levels to that. He didn't like the region. He didn't like the religion of the Puritans and of the New England in general. He thought that they were a narrow and bigoted culture. He liked the more open, relaxed culture of the South. But for the family itself, the drama of his grandmother was this, that Abigail and John Adams had three sons. John took one abroad with him on his diplomatic work, John Quincy, and left two behind with Abigail. Abigail was a mother who kept saying, you've got to live up to your father, you've got to live up to your father, you can never do anything wrong. Her attitude can be seen from the fact that when John Quincy was about to come back, he was about 13 then, she wrote him, come back from Europe, she wrote him a letter saying, if Europe has corrupted you, you know, 13-year-old, I hope that the boat bringing you home will sink. that's the kind of mother she was. The two that were left behind became bankrupt drunkards and died very young. Well, the same thing happened in the next generation. John Quincy, having married Louisa, had to go abroad and took her with him, but said she could only take one of their three children and had to leave the other two behind with Abigail. And Louisa protested this strenuously and said, no, 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 I don't want to abandon my children. And the family closed ranks and said that she had to leave them. And sure enough, those two that were left behind also became drunkards and abject failures. And the oldest one committed suicide. That was the one that she felt closest to because she had delivered him on an earlier diplomatic trip in St. Petersburg in Russia, where John Quincy was serving, after many miscarriages. This was her first child that was finally born. And she had brought him back across Europe during Napoleon's 100 days when he escaped from exile and came back and was fighting on the continent. She came back through this war-torn continent alone because John Quincy had gone to a peace conference. So she felt very close to this first son, George Washington Adams, he was called. And they wrote poetry to each other and that kind of thing. When he committed suicide at age 29 or 30, she was so distraught and convinced that the family had destroyed her child that she wrote, pay no attention to what I said then, I was out of my mind, the denunciations. But it's because of that episode that Henry wrote in the margins of his brother Brooks's book, John Quincy was a demonic man. So his attitude toward the people who had mistreated Louisa was not at all filial and warm.
It paints a very bad and rather different picture of Abigail Adams than I guess I had had before.
That's right. David McCullough's wonderful book, he's in love with her, and rightly so. She was a wonderful wife, but she was a terrible mother, a terrible grandmother. And partly for the same reasons, that she just thought John was so wonderful that the children could never live up to him, and so she was constantly trying to make them live up to him, which is, as you know, not a healthy way to bring up children.
Well, we have another caller here, someone in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Very interesting about the scribes. Were there professional scribes who would somehow certify that they had copied accurately? Because with the archives opening, maybe there weren't indexes and so on. And how would one find a single letter that implicated someone? And
well,
how did the scholar get over to use the archives? Ben Franklin, according to speakers on this show, used to personally introduce people, but later on, did they use, like, letters of references, ID cards, to get into archives?
Yeah, Henry used his connections, of course, because he had served in England as part of the diplomatic corps there himself, and his father was known and respected, and the family history had made people open. And so he made contacts. Also, he had already set up scholarly contacts. So partly his access was political, and partly it was through the scholarly world. French scholars said, oh, yeah, let this guy in. Let him copy anything he wants. So he would go through the documents. Most of them were filed according to the year and according to the diplomat who was reporting back. He would go through and make a list of each of the things that he wanted copied. He had certified them himself on the scene. He worked feverishly at it and then had the copyist copy them out.
All right. Well, I hope they get to the question of the caller. Again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Going back to the history, what sort of things do you think that you learn from reading Henry Adams writing about Jefferson and Madison that you might not otherwise appreciate if you were reading other accounts of the same period?
Well, there are many things. One of them, certainly, is the international setting. He was the first, really, to tell the story of America with constant awareness of all of the things that were being done to us by other people that parochial historians of America don't pay much attention to. It's very difficult because Americans themselves often didn't know what was up because transportation was so slow then. You know, it took months for documents to travel to Europe and then come back. And there were these long gaps where people didn't know what the other side was doing. But, for instance, we depended our success very much on people in Spain and people in Haiti. It was the revolution in Haiti that defeated Napoleon's designs on the New World and had made him sell Louisiana to us. So Adams says, we really owe a great debt to Toussaint Louverture, or a great debt to Godoy, the Spanish diplomat who also opposed Napoleon and delayed his action. On the other hand, Napoleon was able to play with us for year after year after year. He kept saying that he would give us Florida as well as Louisiana. Florida was nominally held by Spain, but he said, I can make them give it up anytime I want. And if you'll just do, you know, oppose the British shipping, the British blockade of Europe, then I'll give you Florida. And both Jefferson and Madison kept playing with him, trying to get Florida. Florida was very important to their constituents. It contained Mississippi and Alabama, the lower strata. Florida, there was East Florida and West Florida then, and so ports like Mobile were things that the Southerners desperately wanted. They also wanted to clear out the Indians, who were somewhat sponsored by the Spanish and could raid into American territory and then go back there. And they just wanted the land. They wanted the cheap land that they thought they could get from Florida. So there was a lot of pressure on Southern presidents to try to get the Floridas out of Napoleon. And he realized that and used it and would always at the last minute say, well, no, not yet. You haven't done quite enough for me. And that went on and on until Florida was not even got until the presidency of Monroe after both Jefferson and Madison were gone. But that constant awareness of the interplay between what was going on in England, in Spain, in France, in the Caribbean, nobody had put that background so clearly as the place, the context in which we have to read American events. Mm-hmm.
And does it add anything to you to the understanding of this, this early on, this basic struggle between two ideas of what America should be, to and two ideas of what American government should be and what politics should be and how people should participate or which people could participate?
The two ideas, you mean Federalist and Republican?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, Adams, as I say, was very critical of the Federalists. He thought they were narrow, they were regional, they didn't reach out, they didn't have a national vision. During the War of 1812, they were semi-traitorous. They didn't cooperate. They capitalized on the advantages that they had, controlling money and that kind of thing during the war. The Republicans, on the other hand, he said, they did have a national vision, a sense of destiny. They did forge a national party. And in doing it, they had to give up much of their ideology. Their ideology of small government, for instance. You can't have a national vision and a national party and keep small government in mind. For instance, Jefferson was against patronage. That was the country ideology, was that patronage was a source of corruption. And when he came into office, he said, well, I'm not going to turn out all the Federalists and put in Republicans. As long as they're doing their jobs, I'm going to be above party. But, of course, he needed Pennsylvania and New York to make the Republican Party be more than a Southern slave-based party. And they said to him, wait a minute, we've worked with you. You've got to work with us. You've got to give us some of these revenue collecting posts, and so he had to do it. And over to get his aim, he had to give up his end. He had to give up the means that he would have preferred. For instance, he had to support the 12th Amendment, which said that a vice president has to run on a ticket with the president. Well, once you did that, you had a regional balancing ticket construction, which was, again, a nationalizing process. So all of the pressures to nationalize were things that he didn't want at the outset, but he was able to do in a way that the Federalists never could have. When he did buy Louisiana, despite his own constitutional scruples, he had to govern it, and he had to govern it by tremendous executive fiat. He appointed the governors, he appointed the military commanders, he appointed the justices of the peace, all of that without Congress. So he was taking on presidential powers constantly. When he put on an embargo, in order to enforce it, he had to use the army in a very high-handed way. So some people say, well, power overtook him. He became a Federalist, in effect. What Adams argues is that the country in general escaped from the narrow ideological divisions that had existed up to that point and came to a much more pragmatic understanding of what America should be like. One of the things that happened in that period was that the Federalist love affair with England got broken. The War of 1812 destroyed it. And the fact that the church leaders had been against the war discredited them, which he thought was a good thing, the New England church leaders. And the Republican love affair with France got discredited because Napoleon overthrew the revolution and restored imperial power. So that a lot of the animus, the tremendous emotional investment in those early struggles between Hamilton and Jefferson, say, had been struggles of people who were taking as their model either England or revolutionary France. Well, he said all of that romance was gone by the end of the 16 years that he's describing, and he thinks that's a very good thing.
We're coming down here to the point where we have maybe about 4 or 5 minutes left, and a sort of basic point I'm interested in having you talk about is this. We certainly know that within the last, I don't know, 5, 10 years, we've been in a publishing cycle of books having to do with the founding generation in America, and there have been a great number of them, and apparently they have sold very well, and people are very interested. But at the same time, I think that some people have looked at some of these books and said that the picture that they paint of the founders is maybe a bit too rosy, and that it is important that we see them as much as we can at this distance. We see them for the people that they were. We assess them fairly. We acknowledge that there perhaps were negatives as well as positives. And do you think that is the case? That is perhaps that some of the popular history that has been written about early America recently is not completely balanced and doesn't give us a fully developed picture of these men.
Well, I don't think it's more idolatrous than the ones in the past. In fact, there's a lot more now known about the faults of those people. And for instance, the tremendous impact of slavery is much, much more taken into account in these biographies than in earlier ones. How the South was fettered to protecting the slave interest. That comes through very clearly in all of this recent work. When you have Ellis talking about Washington, for instance, even though Washington is in some ways the best, who did free his slaves on his wife's death, he's quite censorious, and he makes it clear that he came only very late to fairly humane views of slavery, that he was typical up to a certain point in the way he treated them. And, of course, he had to keep secret that he was going to free them because it would have destroyed his political influence if they had known that. No major figure in the South, with no major political figure in the South, freed his slaves. Even Washington only did it posthumously and secretly. And none of the others did. The people who freed their slaves were not people with political ambitions, unless they freed, you know, two or three. The system was geared so that you couldn't free them. You couldn't just free a slave. You had to guarantee a job, an income, or get him out of the state, or in some other way, take care that he was not just drifting around idle and with no work. So Washington had to accumulate a great deal of money and put it in a trust to pay these slaves when they were freed. And they were paid into the 1830s. I've seen the account book. The system really made it difficult. The South didn't want freedmen. They didn't want the example to be there for other slaves. They didn't want people drifting in and out of plantations or into cities without having them pegged down the way they had been before. All that picture of slavery is now much, much better understood, better documented than in the past, and it shows in most of these biographies.
We're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time for those who are listening who would like to read the book we've talked about. It is Henry Adams and the Making of America. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. It's out now by our guest, Gary Wills. He's adjunct professor of history at Northwestern University. And thank you very much for talking with us today.
Good talking with you.
Focus 580, this program, and in fact everything else here on AM 580, is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The broadcast today is also made possible with support from Wind, Water, and Light, now in downtown Champaign, featuring holiday gift ideas from local and national artisans and contemporary fine crafts, such as painting, photography, jewelry, pottery, wood, fiber, and more. Wind, Water, and Light, far from the ordinary at 10 Main Street in downtown Champaign. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine. Sitting in today as the host is Tom Rogers.
Good afternoon, Dave, and good noontime, rather. And in the 1 o'clock hour, we will have an archive interview with Celeste Quinn, who was talking to historian Gary Nash, who has written a book called The Unknown American Revolution, telling us some